Off the ball. Rugby.
It's a more appealing game to watch, for example, New Zealand and Ireland, South Africa, because of the way South Africa, brilliantly tactically set up to win games.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Well, I'll start with an easy one. How did you find your first games?
From a performance side of view, we didn't do as well as we wanted to going in, as in like in the performances in the games. So throughout the whole year, we'd been kind of up and down and performing really well and then average. So we kind of had targets that we didn't meet at the games. So that's always disappointing. But from an overall Olympics, I had a great experience off the field. I obviously use our individual athletes and team athletes, but I think our team is really close-knit. Like, we travel so much together throughout the year that it is like your family. I know it's such a cliche thing to say. We do fight like family as well.
I was going
to
say, I know myself, you bring a lot of egos together. Like, you're all high-performing athletes. You bring a lot, and high-performing athletes come with a certain amount of ego. You're competitive with each other, with yourselves, with everybody else. Like, that, does that make that difficult? Is there a lot of... Now, I don't want to open a can of worms here.
Tell us everything. I think it's funny because sevens is such a high-performance sport, but there's no room for egos, because if you don't have the girls next to you or anyone, like, there's no way of performing without them.
Yeah.
Like, you need each other so much that, yeah, we keep each other in check, but...
That's class.
Yeah. I don't know, what is it like being an individual athlete? Like, I've never done any individual sports. It's just not in me.
There's a certain amount of it is nice, because it's like, okay, the book stops with you, so whatever you're doing, it's on you. So, and whatever you want to do, you have the complete, to a certain extent, you have coaches, physios, and everyone else. That's your kind of backroom team. But at the end of the day, the book stops with you, which is nice. But then that comes with that added bit of pressure. My most successful year was this year with the mixed relay team. And I loved working as part of a team, because you can share, like standing on the top of the podium at the Europeans, getting the gold medal, was really nice to be able to share with other people. And also then, I feel like, especially for the rugby, and what for the mixed relay, you're reaching.
Because I always think, like, it's different. Say you guys are a team sport, but what happens, like, when they're picking the team and deciding who's on the pitch or, like, who's in the boat? Because, like, you guys qualify the boat first, right?
Yeah, ours is, like, the weirdest mismatch of team and individual.
Yeah.
There's only two, so it's kind of individual because, like, realistically, it's, like you said, it's all on you. But it is kind of still, like, either I mess up or he messes up or we both get it perfect. So, and you know who, there's no hiding. If you messed up, you messed up. It's very hard to, if you were the one who didn't handle it or you didn't pick it up or you're starting to get a bit slower, like, there's no lying to the times. Like, if you're 2 seconds off your PB, then that you're opened up. Like, there's no hiding.
The clock doesn't lie.
Yeah,
the
clock never lies. But
so how is it like training with somebody and then not actually going and being with that person in the boat?
It's weird because it's not a skilled sport. You're just like sitting chomping away for miles and miles and miles, and you're literally like, you're forced within a meter of each other inside of a boat. So we do take breaks from each other, but it is that kind of, because you're competing against each other as well.
Like,
you're a team of what, 15 goes?
14 go, 12 play.
Yeah. And then you, if you hit a time, you go, but you're not then competing against another Irish 400 meter hurdler.
No,
it's you hit the time and you go, or you don't, or you don't go, pretty much. Whereas for us, there's probably 6 or 7 lads who probably
could have gone.
They might not have got the same performance, but they could have been at the event.
Yeah.
So like all year, we're literally like, how are you? And then the next day, you need to be able to like
work together.
No, like take their head off.
I was going the wrong way.
No.
And then you have to go into a boat together when it comes to the
So you go all in with the individuals, and then you have to like.
It is. It's the same with the
relay. Head on.
And you're fighting each other all season.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to the championships, you're then put together on a team.
Similar. Yeah. It was one thing we did fall out about once, and we didn't speak for a day or two, and then one of us was just like, right.
One of us not being you, obviously.
Yeah, I was like, so not you.
No, it was me, actually.
He's just being modest.
One of the guys I lived with wasn't in our boat, but he was very friendly with Dara. And I was like, invite him around for coffee there. But don't tell him I'm going to be home. So he invited him around, and then I popped in, and then I sat down, sat him in the living room, and was like, I'm not leaving this room until we get it sorted.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you'd let that build over weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
And it's hard because, like, you're exhausted all the time. You're training together 6-7 hours a day, and you need to not have those little things.
The closer you get to camp championships and stuff, the higher the tension becomes, the higher the pressure becomes. Yeah. And any little weaknesses like that become huge cracks. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. But especially with the games, I find, like, one of the biggest pieces is, like, the media piece that you don't really have in the same capacity any other year.
Yeah.
So that... Like, for us, it's different because, like, we do it and we're just speaking about ourselves or our own event. But, like, for you guys, I'm sure there's, like, a completely new dynamic in that, like, you're speaking about yourself and the team, and then different people are going to perceive what you say and how you say it in different ways.
I think for, like, us, obviously, we have a really, really big squad.
Yeah.
And what's good about that is no one person is always in the limelight. Or, like, obviously, you have your people who are just high performers and people know them a little bit better, but I think for us, we share the media responsibilities, and that's really good in a sense because you're not thinking of what you have to say constantly. Like, some people aren't natural speakers in front of cameras or to interviewers, so I think it's really nice in a sense that you get to hear other people's opinions. And then I think one thing we were always told was always bring it back to the team, which is such a nice thing to be able to do. So I think it's so much easier for us in teams. Well, I find it's easier in a team than if I was to sit there and have to speak about myself. I'd be like, like I made like a tackle, not saying it was good or bad. Like,
you know, just everything like, is ambiguous. Pick it up whatever way you want to take it.
Yeah, you're like, oh, Amy Lee scored a try. It was brilliant. Team try, yeah. Brilliant, yeah. But I think it's so different for you, especially, and I noticed it around the games where at your events and stuff, it was major media after, like after you finish race, there's literally a walk for media and stuff. And that was the first time we had experienced that at a tournament, because we wouldn't have that usually at tournaments, where you'd have to walk through the media to then go into the changing rooms. We'd usually have our little meeting on the field and then go straight back to the dressing room and have a hot wash, like.
Yeah.
So, like, that was really different, having people get pulled by the media straight off the field, because we're not used to processing it that quick and then having to go speak to people about it.
Like, somewhere. When it goes well, if you've, for me anyway, like, if you've run well, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Because you're getting the raw emotion, you know.
Yeah, there's a real
to the point that you're like, afterwards, you're like, oh my God, I was smiling so much there, I was too happy.
And
but it's if it's not gone well and you have to try and compose yourself, you're absolutely wrote off.
Honestly.
And people are trying to ask you, like, what went wrong? And you're like, my race was less than 12 seconds. I don't know.
You probably have a better idea after seeing it.
Honestly.
It's so fresh as well after you lose. Like, say, for example, Paris for me.
Paris for you was like...
I had the world number one in my first match. So obviously I knew going to be a really, really tough one. And he'd been my role model since I was young. And he's never lost a major.
But you did have a bye this time. So, say, compared to Tokyo, you were in a different position.
Exactly, yeah. And it was direct knockout this time for the first time ever. So we had group stages in Tokyo, so you kind of got to play your way in a little bit. But I remember being interviewed by RTE, like, directly after the match. And it is hard to kind of find the words, because even though it was probably one of my best performances ever. Yeah, but still, obviously, really, really disappointed to be finished up, because, like, you train for 4 years and obviously you want to be out there as much as possible, and, you know, to be ninth in the world and then be drawn against the world number one. I needed to be in the top eight to be seeded.
Yeah.
So that would be my next goal.
It's so typical, isn't it?
It's hard.
It is, and I can imagine, like, it's one of those times where you're like, 4 years has gone into a look, like, pot luck. Look at the draw.
Look at the draw, yeah.
Yeah.
That's tough to...
Such small margins as well. Yeah. I was leading in the first two sets, and, you know, could have.
Well, then, see the day of your match, did you go into it thinking, I have to upset his victory? Or did you think, I have a chance of beating him?
Yeah, well, I'd say, like, as Orla said, I had the bye in the round of 32, and Feng Pan Feng has been my role model for 10 years, so I know very well how he plays. I've watched lots of videos of him, and so I was quite well prepared going in, and, you know, I obviously wasn't as nervous as maybe I would have been if I felt that, you know, this is a really, really close one. I can win this match, but I knew going in I just had to play my max, and that's what I did. I very much stuck to the plan that my coach and I had made, and I don't really have much regrets. Like, looking back, I left it all out there on the table, and it was an unforgettable match, probably the best one that I've ever played, and so enjoyable to do it in such an amazing arena in front of such a big crowd. Like, it was just such a different experience to Tokyo, where, you know, I was disappointed with my performance. I drew China also, the second Chinese in Tokyo. But this was really, really different. I kind of look back on it quite fondly, and it's given me a lot of motivation to continue.
What age are you now, Colin?
29.
I have loads of time.
Table tennis, I think you can continue a bit longer. You know, where it's not like you guys were, you're very much measured on your speed.
Yeah.
Table tennis is, it's more about being relaxed. It's quite technical.
Technical adventure.
You know, I feel like as I've matured, I've become a much better player.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not as fast as I used to be.
Yeah, but I suppose like mindset's a big part for like. So you were saying it's like who you get drawn against, but that's the same for you guys. And does it matter so much for you as well?
We were seeded too, so it was a little bit. We went into our final against the Dutch, who again were undefeated, and then were defeated that day, even not by us. But like we'd had so many tussles against them, and the closest we'd ever got to them was like 2 seconds. We were obviously going backwards. You can't see until you come up alongside them. So I started to see their bit of their boat coming, and I was like, that means they're probably a second ahead of us, roughly. And then whenever I can see the whole of this part of their boat, I'm like, right, we're level. And then whenever I can see one of their lads, I'm like, right, we're slightly ahead. So I could see the boat, but I wasn't.
Would you ever look? Would you ever have a little cheeky look?
Have a wee look. You might have a wee.
Lose
the thing. Yeah. So I would have like a cheeky little, but not in a sprint, like maybe in the middle. And then I was like, God, we're close enough here. Like this is the closest we've ever been. If we can really lift it here now. So we tried to lift it, and then we started steering a bit, but they lifted it as well. But I watched the video back, and us, them, and the Romanians are like, with 200 metres to go, are literally like in a straight line. So like the goal was on, but in my mind, I was like, we're not here for the goal. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
in my mind, I was like, we're here to cause an upset for silver, or we're probably on paper bronze or silver. We could maybe cause an upset for gold if we have the perfect race. But then watching the video back, I was like, if I had a little earpiece and somebody had told me, it would have been different, but maybe it wouldn't have. But that's why I was asking you, like, does that change your motivation on the day? Are you trying to win the match, or are you trying to like stop him from winning? You know, because that's a different mindset. Like going out to win a game or going out to stop somebody else from winning a game is
it's the difference of playing your best versus playing the game against your opponent.
Yeah, obviously you have to be aware of the score, but you kind of have to look at it in the right way as well.
Because if you're looking at 8-6 thinking, God, I shouldn't be up.
Because he should
be beating me.
Or then, maybe I need to maybe take my foot off the gas here and let him make the mistake. You know, because I suppose like what got me to winning 8-6 is like taking the initiative, like taking the risks.
Yeah.
Mm. And then, you know, you think when you're 8-6 up, oh, maybe I shouldn't risk as much anymore.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the game's finished. So it's like,
when you're the underdog, it's like, I've nothing to lose here.
If you're 8-4 down, like so many sets, I win 11-8 because you're not so much worried or thinking about the score as much. So
it's
like looking at the boat and the rowing, like, or I'm sure.
I'd love to have been in your opponent's head at that stage when he was like 8-6 down and he's like, oh.
And like, even though like table tennis is obviously incredibly fast in the point, but like you have time between the points as well, and you've got time to think.
Were you using that like delay tactic if he was sweating? Were you using that time, using the clock against?
I'm very much a delay man. I like to take my time, like, and you know the umpire is always giving out to me about it. But I kind of just pretend that I have to readjust myself, and you know, pretend there's water, and you know, you've got to.
But
just,
it's all part of the game.
You've
got
to play the game.
That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was a Russian guy I played in Tokyo, and he knocked me out in the last 16, and he's like extremely vocal. Like with table tennis, like you're super close to each other, and like he's like looking in the eye and like screaming in your face, with the arm, like, and you know, I'd encourage myself, but it would be very much towards me, it wouldn't be towards my opponent.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's, I mean, obviously everyone has their way to behave on the table, but I've never been like that, and it can be. You know, obviously experienced at this time, but like I remember a few years ago, that was really off-putting for me.
Yeah.
To have someone like screaming in your face, like, and like really cheering when you make a mistake, and you know, things like this, it's not very good sportsmanship.
No, at all. It was on a lot in sevens.
Yeah.
Really? So much chatter between the players.
It's so funny.
I literally just laugh at it now, though. Like, obviously,
it probably disarms someone if they're trying to, like, throw a dig at you and you laugh at them.
No, but, like, as in, like, we played Australia in a game and going into scrums and stuff, they'd say the randomest stuff, like, your lace is untied, and you'd look at your lace and they'd be like, well,
Oh my god!
It's such like pet
mind
stuff.
Games.
It's proper messing. And we had to put in a complaint this year because some of it was really bad towards one girl on our team. And it was like, you're just like, you never think you'd have to do that because it's like a gentleman's sport or whatever. Yeah. Like, you know. But honestly,
can you trust the refs to kind of pull people up on that sort of stuff?
Sometimes they do. Like, but sometimes I just don't think they hear or see it. Like, there was one time where someone was grabbing my legs in a game and I was like, ref, she's all over me, like putting the ball into a scrum, and I was like, she's all over me, ref. And then I was like, that doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah. What am I calling out?
The ref even think, like,
is she marking me very
it's
well,
honestly yeah, like, you just wouldn't even know what to say. But there's so much chatter, and then there's so much chat to the ref, even though technically you're not allowed to speak to the referees in sevens. Yeah. It's a little bit more of a leeway because there's so little of us on the field that you kind of have to speak to the ref sometimes. But the refs, like, just don't talk back to you, or they were like, right, enough of that. And then sometimes you ref the game with them and you're like, that's a knock on, and she's like, I know it's a knock on, and you're like, oh, sorry about that.
You're doing an amazing job, sorry.
And you're like, oh my bad, didn't mean that. But yeah, there's way more of that in like our sports, but not that you'd ever really see.
We do a lot of psyching out, to be honest.
You don't have to weigh in, sure.
Even the days, because we'd all train on the lake for the days beforehand.
Yeah.
So we're all there like 4 or 5 days beforehand, all training. You just do this, like, everyone just does laps. So, like, small boats, so going the inside two lanes, and then the bigger boats and those two, and the bigger boats, and you just go around in circles. And, like, say the Spanish men were behind us, and they were quite close. Like, Dara would have a quick look, and he'd be like, Spain behind, two lengths. And then we're like, right, kick it up. Like, just, burst, like, sprint at them essentially, because they have to move, so we would just hockey it at them and they'd have to move, and sometimes they leave it to the last minute, and then Dara will go harden up, and then you just like shoot the blades really, and you try and like hit their blades with yours, and then on the warm up you'd be like doing the same. And then we warm up on the machines first. Inside there's like a big warm up area with all their own machines, and like if say they were on those two, we'd like go each side of them. Or we like sit beside them and just make sure we were always going to be a bit faster than them. Or the best one actually is the cool down. So we always do a long cool down. Like, our cool downs could be nearly an hour sometimes on the row machine or the bike. So you'd go and you'd sit beside whoever you're, you know, you would know the results, and you were like, all right, I have to race them the next day. And you go and sit beside them. And then I used to do that. I did this thing in 2019 when we've won our first ever medal, and I've done it a good few times since. Is afterwards people just usually just, you know, you're nice and gentle. I would do 3 5-minute, like, nearly all out pieces. I'd like,
but is this
threshold.
Not just taking your energy?
No, it actually gives.
But you think it gives
I
you energy?
Took
okay,
so much
yeah.
from this, like, yeah. I genuinely took so much. Like, just watch, like, as I was just like, and people were like, what's going on there? And then I just, like, afterwards, Dara's like, everyone was watching you, and I was like, you know.
He loves the attention.
Yeah. Because they're like, geez, he mustn't have been that. They must have had that race easy because they're, you know, they're doing
a session. Yeah.
But what we actually found was the lightweights figured it out, is that higher intensity, like 3 or 4 5-minute higher intensity pieces, is actually a better flush for lactate than that real slow, because you usually always go way slower than you need to be.
That's not why you were doing it, though.
That's what I started doing in 2019. And there was this British guy called John Collins, who's retired now. And after our semi-final, we'd beaten him, and I went and did the 5 minutes. And then he got the third qualifying spot, and we got the first. And then we were going into the A-final. And afterwards, I would have been friendly enough with him. And usually you don't speak to each other until it's all over. There's usually like a bit of, well, or whatever, but no chat. And then when it's all over, you're best friends and you meet up or whatever. But he came up to me after the thing, and he's like, what the hell are you doing? And I was like, 5 minute pieces. And he's like, why are you not tired? And I was like, no. Like, just we do it to clear the lactate. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, no, serious. And that was whenever I realised, I was like, they're watching. Like, that's annoying.
People out.
Like, that's, he's thinking about that. He's sitting having his dinner going like, why,
Maybe I should
why
do that.
Is your man doing yeah. 5 minutes?
Has anything ever psyched you out off someone though?
If you see people just like you can, you know, when you just see somebody and you're like, they look like they're going well, like us, you can tell just if boats seem to be moving well or if we were rowing along and we were going hard and another boat came through us, we'd be like, geez, they're like that, we weren't going slow. Then they, so that's the, you try and do it to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. I kind of love that bit of it.
Do you?
Yeah, that gives me, I take from that a lot. And if someone even tries to do it to me, I'm like, they're worried. Like, I take from that, that gives me a lot. And then there was a German boat. We raced the World Cup, literally the last World Cup before the Olympics. There's no other competitions until then. And these German lads came second to us. We won it and they came second. And then one of the Dutch guys actually sent me this interview. It was in German. And he was like, can you speak German? And I was like, no. And then he was like, well, I speak German, French. And I was like, cool, Stefan. And then, because they obviously speak about 17 different languages. And then he was like, I'll translate. He was like, he's saying bad things about you.
Oh, my God.
So we had them in the heat. So I told Dara, and then we had them in the heat. And, like, that just fueled Dara. Like, Dara didn't care if he won the heat or lost. As long as he beat the Germans, that was it.
Yeah.
All he wanted to do. And then at the halfway mark, we were coming away, and I could, like, feel him, like, then just, like, we were moving, like, away from getting further, and I could just feel Dara just getting more and more energy.
Yeah.
The further we got away, and he was just loving it. And then we finished, and I was like, well, how was that? And he was like, I really wanted to shout something at him during the race. I was like, but I forgot we're on the Olympics and somebody might hear. So he was like, I kept it to myself. Because it would even be such a flex. Like, imagine the middle of your 400 metre hurdles. You're going over the fourth hurdle. See and it. The guy's over there.
But I think in athletics, all that stuff, like any messing, you don't see anyway because it would be in call rooms. But to be honest, I think people think call rooms are these mad spaces where people are trying to psych each other out. Like, no. Everybody's just kind of doing their own thing. Like, you don't really pay attention to what other people are doing. So, like, it's just all about you getting your race prep right. But I'm curious about how you find those spaces when you're in a relay team versus individual.
I way prefer it because, it's just, I feel way more relaxed when I'm with other people in the call room because it's like, oh, we're all here now. We all know each other. We're all having a bit of crack. And go out. Like, when you're on your own, it's very much just, like I always find anyway, you're so busy just getting yourself ready. You're getting your spikes on, getting your number on. They'll give you a little transponder for your bib. They're checking your spikes. They're checking everything else. You'll go to the toilet. And then all of a sudden, you have time to maybe do like a bit of high knees or a stride out if there's a bit of a track that you can use. And then it's time to go out.
Yeah.
And everyone is so busy in their own heads going through their race plan. Mm-hmm. But I find with the relay, for sure, I find it way more easy to get through. Yeah.
Do all the teams warm up together?
As in all of the relay teams from
in
other countries?
One place, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there'll be a warm-up track outside the stadium. Or if it's not, like, say for the Olympics, there's a warm-up track for other smaller events. There might be, like, a strip of tartan or a field. But, yeah, everyone warms up in the same space. Yeah. And it comes to a certain time in the warm-up where... So everyone will do their individual warm-up. Could take 45 minutes or so. And then it comes to a point where all the teams are wanting to do baton changeovers.
Oh, right.
So everyone is like wanting the same 4 meters of track to start doing baton changeovers. And it's carnage because you have people just running left, right and centre. And everyone's trying to absolutely nail it before they go out.
And when people
track.
Speak different languages as well, like someone calls track and then someone doesn't move.
Yeah.
Like, so that shout.
Yeah, like that's the comment. Like if you are on an athletic track and you hear someone shouting track, you're in the way.
Oh.
But if you don't understand that language, you know, you're going to get run into.
Yeah.
In 400 hurdles, or like there's almost like a mutual respect amongst athletes of how bloody difficult the 400 hurdles is. Mm. And because we're in our own lane, we're focused on our own stride patterns, kind of not really putting in or out on anyone. Is there much of that in the hundreds?
No, I think it's the same. It's sort of like at the end of the day, all you can control is what happens in your lane.
Yeah.
And... like, to an extent, especially, like, in short sprints, like, you can't really see what's going on around you. And if you can, then you're out of the race. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, if you know what's happening or how it's unfolding, it's because you're out the back.
Yeah.
And so I think... and it's also all to play for because, like, in a short sprint, like, anybody can make a small mistake and it's game over. Like, you can, you know, make a false start or you can, you know, trip over your feet in a start and that's it. It's done. Yeah. So even when you go in and there's like someone there is, you know, seated number one or they're the person to beat or, you know, everyone's looking at them, there's also not much point in putting any energy or effort into thinking about them and their race because you're like, I can't do anything about it.
And people used to use false starts to spook other people.
Yeah, but now, if you false start once, you're gone.
Yeah. They used to get a. What they changed the rules. So basically, everyone used to have two chances. Basically, well, one chance.
Yeah.
So if you false started, you could get back into the race.
Yeah.
So you could have four or five false starts, and people used that because it was like
on purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you were draining people's energy, and soaking reactions. Then it went to there was one false start allowed blanket. So if we're all racing, one of us false starts, that's it. Everyone is on a warning, and if the next person false starts, you're gone. So somebody, you would put your money on it, someone is going to false start, to put everyone under pressure then.
Yeah.
But now it's just, there's no chance.
You know, I found it so harsh watching that at the Olympics, because I'm like, you train so hard for four years, and then all of a sudden you just don't get to race. Like,
the actual 110 hurdles were the worst. Did you watch them?
Yeah.
The actual 110, there was like three false starts, two people were rejected, and one was a technical thing.
It was so tough to watch.
Honestly,
I think the funniest thing was like that was the only strange intrusive thought I had at this game.
Oh no!
It was like, well, what if I false start? And I was like, no, stop! Don't go down that road
on the start line. Yeah,
no, just like in general. Like I was sort of like, I think I was in a really good headspace. I felt really good. I felt really confident. I was sort of like, yeah, I'm in the mix here. Like I know what to do. I'm not nervous about my race, and I'm lucky that I don't tend to get very nervous.
Yeah.
I almost have to do the opposite. Like in a call room, I'm like, right, I need to like hype myself up here, like kind of big myself up and get ready to go. And it was just like I was in the warm-up zone, like before I'd even gone into the call rooms. Like I was just like, I feel so great. Like I'm so excited. Like I could barely sleep the night before. I'm so excited. This is my opportunity. I've worked so hard for it. This is amazing. Like it can only go well if I just like believe in myself. I trust in myself. And then my brain was like, and what if you false start? I was like, oh, hello, new intrusive thought.
Where have you come from?
I was like, oh my God, what? And then I was like, no, okay. That's just like something trying to blow me off, you know, off course. I was like, I have to be able to settle that and be like, that's never happened, so it won't happen. And I was like, you just have to be patient. But for me, that was like, actually, because I kind of laughed about it. I was like, that's such a strange thought to have. But I was actually like, do you know what that is? That's something somewhere in my brain reminding me to be patient.
Yeah.
Because I rushed the first half of my race, because it's where I'm fastest. And that also means then I've kind of used up what I have. And I sometimes rush the transition from my drive phase, and I can rush those positions. And so I'm cheating myself out of what I have left at the end. So I was sort of like, do you know what? I think that's somewhere in my brain trying to be like, okay, you have to be patient. Remember, that's the cue. When you're lining up, when you're in the blocks, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm going to false. I'm going to be like, patient. And are you staying for LA?
Are you staying for LA? Is that
Who's staying for LA?
I'm not anyway.
question.
Taking it year by year, but I think I will.
No, open question.
You think
gas
you're gonna...
left in the tank? Yeah. I think, yeah, a little bit. What about
you? I'm the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
the dream is LA. Yeah. It was really funny. At something recently, I was talking to one of the other athletes from our team, Ellen Keane, and she said it was her third games that she won her bronze and her fourth games that she won her gold.
Yeah.
So she was like, it took a bit of time, and I was like, that was my third games and I got a bronze. So I was like, okay.
Goal
challenge
next.
Accepted, Ellen.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure.
Goal set.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I think, to be honest, like I came home from Tokyo so deflated. I was just like, oh my God. Like I had been, that was 8 years at that stage or whatever. And nothing had gone right. I'd been injured constantly. I'd get over one injury and I'd pick up another. It was just like, time and time and time again, or you'd just get back enough to qualify, and then you'd be like, right, like it's all on track, it's going well, and then something would happen. And I was just kind of like, I can't believe I put myself through this year after year. Like there is nothing but misery in it. And like, I know that sounds really dark, and like obviously there's good moments, but I was like, at a certain stage I was like, all of this bad, like it's outweighing any good.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like, at what point am I supposed to call it?
Stop.
Like, what am I supposed to do here? And I remember being at a point where I was like, yeah, but if I was going to quit, I should have done that like 5 years ago. I haven't gone through all this misery for nothing. So I remember at that point being like, okay, well, after Tokyo, I was like, well, I've no choice. I have to keep going. But it was sort of out of like a stubbornness or a competitiveness with myself. It wasn't from anybody else. And that kind of made me be like, okay, well, like, I have to learn from the mistakes. Like, what am I getting wrong here? How can I change that? How can I go forward? Like, I suppose I've spent my whole life, like so many of you guys would have, like having a dream of being at a games, having a dream of winning a medal, having a dream of being at the peak of your sport. And I was not willing to give that dream up. And I'm so glad I didn't. And not that I ever really seriously considered quitting, but it definitely used to cross my mind a lot more than it would now. But I suppose now I kind of thought, like, oh, once I win a medal, does that change that fire or that anything? But it actually just makes me so much more excited because I'm like, okay, now I've had like the highs and the lows. Yeah, it makes it like easier. Yeah, it's more balanced. It makes it easier to be like, I want to chase those highs again because I now know what it is to feel them. Mm. Whereas before I was just like, there has to be something better than this.
Someone once compared high performance athletes to addicts, to actual drug addicts. And I was like, that's a pretty grim sort. But it's so true. You know, you go through, like, you're searching for that one high. Mm. And then you get that high and you're like, I want that, but I want it better.
Yeah.
And then I want that and I want it better. And you keep pushing the boundaries, keep pushing yourself. Mm. It's crazy. And I thought it was a good, well, it was a sort of a dark analogy. I thought it was a very good analogy. And that's why we'll put ourselves through so much torture week in, week out, behind the scenes to get to those.
Yeah. Those and moments. Also, like, the reality is as well that, like, nobody is doing the sports that we're doing for money. You know what I mean? It has to be for something bigger than any of that. And nobody does it for recognition or fame or money or any of that. Like, you really have to be so passionate about it and you have to be so internally driven, especially when you're an individual athlete, that I just think, there has to be something maybe wrong with you to go after it.
If you went to a business advisor, they'd be like, this is not a good business choice. Financially, this is not a good choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do agree, though. I reckon, like, I'm motivated by my team, but being an individual athlete, I'd say you have to be so self-motivated. Like, I just don't think I could do it.
Yeah.
I think it is definitely a different kettle of fish.
It is, but I suppose there's the team element, and I'll always come back to this as well. It's what keeps me going day in, day out is the team element in that.
Yeah, the training.
I go out to training with my, like, there could be only up to 40 of us on the track on any given night. And it's been great crack. You
there's
know, training's
sort of the sanity
always
in all of us. You know what I mean? To have someone as a sounding board or to go back and forth with, or like I
just
even find
a banter.
That's it, to lighten it up. Where I even find, you know, you come to training one day and you're like, God, I feel shite. But someone else is like, God, I don't feel great now. And you're like, oh no, we can't let this take over.
Yeah.
I have to step up my game now so that we all step it up for each other, that you're kind of accountable to someone else.
Exactly.
Even though you're not in the same way that you guys would be in a team.
I think I really miss that in table tennis. You know, it's obviously a minority sport in Ireland. Yeah. And I'm the only high performance player. And so I have to travel a lot abroad to play with other wheelchair players. But our squad is growing now, our pathway and development team. So I'm hoping for LA that, you know, maybe I could have a doubles partner, because I know you were saying earlier, Thomas, about the team. I really miss that. Like, the system has changed in table tennis over the last few years. So I used to play with players from different countries, but now that's not allowed anymore. And I used to enjoy that so much because I never had it. And
Why did they stop that?
It's, now you have to, you can only play with players from the same country, basically. And so Ireland.
But that's actually something that really struck me in the village, was that you had really strong and really close relationships with everybody in table tennis.
The tour,
Or like, if I was with you, people would come over to me and start chatting to me. And I'd be like, who the hell are these people? And I was like, they're all Collins people. Like, you were like the most popular man in the village.
Yeah,
like,
you see, I would have trained a lot with Team GB, France, Germany. They've kind of opened their doors for me, like, throughout my career. And I would have been really lost without that, because, you know, it not only gave me great practice, but it gave me a real motivation, because, you know, I didn't really have much of a role model other than watching Feng on the TV growing up. But, like, there was nobody really else like me playing table tennis in Ireland in the wheelchair. Yeah. And, you know, I found it hard to identify with the able-bodied players. But, you know, it wasn't until I made my international debut and, you know, I went to these training camps and I saw guys with disabilities competing at a really high level you know, it was then that I started to believe, you know, why couldn't I do it too?
But I think that was a huge shift between, say, Tokyo and Paris. Like, even, like, I would have met you in Tokyo, but, like, I wouldn't have had any sense of who you were as an athlete, as a person, because, like, it was just all so separate. Mm. Like, I felt like I was obviously kind of with the athletics gang, but outside of that, like, I didn't really mix with anybody. And then being in Paris, you were like, oh, my God. We actually get on great. That's crazy. I didn't know that for the last three years. But I kind of found being in Paris, like, that was the really big difference, was that I felt like I was part of an Irish team, whereas in Tokyo, I just felt like I was there by myself.
I've done some amount of school visits since I've gotten back from Paris, but it was brilliant because It's just the excitement that you can generate in school, but it's the same.
How many children do you think have touched your relay medal?
I couldn't even count. I have passed that around. It's getting tarnished and bumped and dented and dropped on the floor, but I don't care because it's just the excitement that can be generated off something like that.
Yeah.
And it's the same. And like, I've gotten a lot of messages from teachers afterwards saying, you know, like the kids got something out of that, and they're constantly asking, and it's the same thing. How do you keep them in sport? How, like, and that's what I always try and reiterate is, like, things like, you know, it was somewhere where I made some of my best friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's a social outlet. Like, what kept you going? Like, what year, what age did you all start your sports at?
I started when I was 6.
I was 8, yeah.
I was 11.
I only started playing rugby when I was 17.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry, and you were later as well, weren't you, when you got into rowing?
21 when I started rowing, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you do any sports before that?
Yeah, I played GAA all the way through primary school and then went to a school that didn't play GAA in Northern Ireland and then played hockey for years, played Irish Ulster. Like, my plan was to go to the Olympics in the hockey team. And like,
you came in through a different avenue.
Yeah, like Shane O'Donoghue and all those boys. Like, yeah, I played with them all my life. There's two or three of the lads on the team now were like the year below me in school and we would have played for years. And then I actually then stopped playing competitive sport for like a full year.
At what age?
When I left school. So I stopped at the last year of secondary school and then I didn't pick anything up until the second year of college. So I stopped for 2 full years pretty much.
And I think that's such a beautiful thing about sport that I think, okay, obviously we're all maybe exceptions in that we're in high performance sport. Like most people who take part in sport, that's not why they're there. And I can appreciate that. But I think there's so much to gain from being in sport. Like you said, there's the social element, but it's also what you learn about yourself, what you learn about how you operate, how you kind of build confidence in yourself. And I saw, I suppose, a lot of my peers drop out of the sport.
Yeah.
And I definitely think it was a stage where there was people saying to me, like, oh, that's so embarrassing, you're taking it so seriously.
Really? And that was the best of pressure. And what age is that at?
I was definitely a teenager, maybe 14 or 15. And I remember at that stage being like, why is it embarrassing to try at something?
No.
You know, and I was like, that, like, I love this and it's something I love to do. And okay, if I'm good at it or I'm bad at it, it doesn't really matter. The thing is that I'm trying.
Yeah.
And I found that there was like a little bit of kind of talk at that stage, people being like, oh, it's so embarrassing, you're like trying so hard.
Yeah.
And kind of maybe people moved away from the sport. I think it was just almost that, like, maybe that awkward age where everybody is changing and everybody kind of wants to be like what everybody else is doing. So
everything else is uncool.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cool, yeah. When I was growing up, I personally never felt the desire to stop. And I think I was really lucky in the sense that I had siblings who all played sport and all were really active. And it was always really competitive growing up with them. But I think for me, it was really sad to see girls who I started with stop. Mm. And I think that was kind of hard because you're like losing a part of your team, but you're also losing a part of your own social, like, friend group. And like I get to travel the world with my best friends now. Like, I'm so lucky. And I don't think people, even young girls or young boys, see that you can be a professional athlete and that's a goal you can have in life. And yeah, maybe that's not why you're in the sport, but you get to travel around the country then with your team and have like fun weekends away with the girls or the lads. Like, and I think there's so much more to sport than just playing. And I was always competitive and I used to get that said to me as well, like, oh, why you take it so seriously? There'd be girls like doing cartwheels and stuff, and you're just like, why aren't you taking it seriously?
Yeah,
like,
but I'm like, interested, is that something like that any of the lads would have got, or is that just something that maybe we got? Maybe it was just the girls.
No, I think I definitely think for girls it was a little bit more pronounced. Like, I mean, it was the dropout in female sports was always huge.
Yeah,
I think that's definitely changing, but in for myself as well, there was a big dropout, but. Like, we're noticing as well that, as when I was younger, it was kind of in that sort of third, fourth year of school, secondary school, and it's getting younger and younger and younger now. Probably with social media, people are more aware of themselves. People are more, like, there's more confidence issues, maybe. But I reiterate what you're saying.
And when you say confidence issues, and I'm like, but that's what sport's so good for.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, you should be staying.
Yeah.
Like, when I was younger, you know, people ask you what you want to do.
Yeah.
I always was like, oh, I want to run for Ireland, but I was too embarrassed to say it out loud. Like, in my head, I was like, I want to do.
I wanted to be a digger driver.
We knew that now, Tom.
I know.
Like, that's not something that's viable. That's not something I can say out loud. And I kind of always kick myself that I never did, but I'm glad that I got there. But I went back to my primary school last week, and there was one little girl came up to me, and she was like, I'm going to go to the Olympics.
Love
and
it.
I was like, she's saying it out loud. That and then there was another brilliant. One who was like, you said that I shouldn't stop like believing in my dreams, and I'm not going to. And I was like, I was like, this is what it's about. I was like, it's so incredible, because I was like, I was the same kids in that same hall, yeah. And I would have been too shy to say that out loud. Yeah. And for them to come up and use their voice and be like, that's what I want to do, that's where I want to be, like, that's just like, it's so incredible to see, and it's such an exciting, you can really feel that energy catching, like, yeah. When you go into those schools and you can see.
That's why it's so important. Like, it was great that Paris was really close and good time zone for Ireland, because I think we will see the ripple effect of hopefully young girls and boys like actually picking up more sports and staying in sport and having that drive to, oh my God, I can represent my country, or I can play for my county, or like whatever it is, like just knowing that that's a possibility and having that visibility, like that would, that's so good. But I'm like,
why do you think people drop out?
I just think it's so much easier to not play than play when all your friends, like when I was younger, maybe around 15, 16, a lot of people would stop, and I think that's when like boys become a thing, or like drinking or going out with your friends on the weekends rather than on going playing a match in wherever, and you can't do anything on Friday or Saturday because your match is on Sunday. Like, it kind of stops what you think is the socials part of life, when actually the girls who you're doing it with are the exact same as you. Like, they're not going out on a Friday night so that we can perform and have this like great high on a Saturday playing a game.
Because I feel like a lot of times people used to ask me about like the sacrifice to be an athlete and to be in the position that we're in, and like, I understand where the question comes from, but I'm kind of like, I always kind of hesitate to use the word sacrifice, because you're like, well, it's a choice, like, and it is a privilege to get to do your sport at such a high level and to be in that position. And okay, maybe it does feel sometimes like when you miss someone's birthday or you miss an important occasion because you're off the other side of the world, it maybe feels in those moments like, God, I'm missing out. But really, like, it is a choice. And okay, maybe I sacrifice going to the pub every weekend with my friends, but I enjoy seeing them more because I don't get to do it all the time. I say like, okay, I get to go down to them every, you know, when I finish a block of training, I'll go down and join them. I get to have that moment. But then every day in and out, I get to have those moments with other people on the track, or with even like something like this, you come together with other sports people. Like, there are lots of other options. Like, it's not just going to the pub with everyone, or it's not just doing what everyone's doing. Like, there are so many more options. And I think people are starting to see now that those options can be in activity or can be in a sport.
It's also like daring to go down that road and see where it's going to take
you. The road less traveled, I suppose.
Yeah, see where it's going to take you. Like, what's the worst to try? Like, I definitely am an advocate for try anything, try everything. Like, I tried out every sport in athletics. I tried out every event until I found what worked for me and what I liked. And then just see where it goes, like, you know.
I do think it's definitely a culture shift at the minute, and hopefully that reflects in sport for the dropout, because you don't want to see a dropout in sport. And the more people who stay in sport, like, the better Ireland as a whole is going to perform at an Olympics or, like, even county football or whatever it is.
Okay, we're talking about dropout and people getting involved in sport. Do you think, and because I feel like you and I probably are in a better position to talk about this, but if anyone else has thoughts, the accessibility piece is a barrier to people getting involved, or is a reason that people are dropping out?
Yeah, absolutely, Orla. I was actually going to chip in with that. Like, I always look back to when I was 11 years old and, you know, growing up in an able-bodied rugby school. Rugby obviously wasn't an option for me. And I remember the first sport I tried was wheelchair rugby, and I really, really enjoyed it, but I wasn't very good at it. And I was a competitive person even back then.
That's a dangerous sport, man.
It's
even interesting that you where did you have accessibility to join a team or to try that out? Well, was that much harder to find than, say, like, your peers were to, like, join their local club?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, it would only nearly have been once a year where I would have been at, like, a multi-sport camp with IWA or whatever. Would have tried out a lot of different sports, and I tried out table tennis. It was the only sport that I could beat my brother at, so.
A good reason.
This was the one for me. But, you know, I'd realised that, and I kind of knew then that I needed a sport, that I wanted to play table tennis. But the next step was joining a club, and that was, like, a big one for me. Mm. It was obviously going to be an able-bodied club, and I was so nervous. Like, I was only 11 years old. But I remember sending an email to the coach in UCD, And, you know, I look back on that moment so clearly. Like, it was such a big thing for me at the time because, you know, I was kind of terrified to put myself out there, you know, because, you know, I could beat my brother, but realistically, I wasn't any good. And, like, the able-bodied guys at the club are going to be much better, and I didn't want to be a nuisance to anyone. And, you know, I think looking back on it, people are often, you know, a lot nicer than they seem. And, you know, my coach back then, I sent him that email and he took me under his wing and it all went from there. And
like, imagine you hadn't sent that email.
Yeah. That was very possible. And so that's what I'd say is, like, to never be afraid to, I was going to say take the first step, but that's... take the initiative is probably a better way to describe, and then just not to be afraid to fail in the beginning, because of course. So what I would say to kids nowadays is to not be afraid to put yourself out there, and, you know, to take that initiative. And, you know, I just think that if I hadn't sent that email, I definitely wouldn't be.
I'll often ask myself a question if I'm going to do something that I've never done before, and thinking, like, what's the worst that happens if I don't do this? Or if I do it, what's the worst that's going to happen? So if you hadn't sent that, or if you had sent that email and it had come back, what's the worst that's going to happen? They say, no, sorry, we can't.
So it's the same result as not sending it. So you might as well send it and see what happens.
But at least you know the answer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was probably the big moment for me. And then, you know, since then, obviously, table tennis has been more than a sport for me. It's helped me deal with my disability, which probably that was the main reason why I started sport in the first place, is because I was really struggling growing up in an able-bodied school, St. Michael's College. And, you know, I was the only one with one arm and no legs, and I was obviously quite different. And, you know, sport just gave me a lot of confidence in myself. I set goals, I achieved those goals, and, you know, then the success that I achieved in table tennis definitely translated to other areas of my life, socially and academically as well. And, you know, it all started from that one email.
And there's so many benefits.
Yeah. But it's also now you're that person for someone else maybe who is in a position and has those same struggles or those same questions or fears or concerns, that they can be like, okay, look, there's these other people that I can look to and say, like, right, well, they've done it. So what's standing in my way? There's no reason to think just because the people directly around you aren't doing things a certain way or don't look the same as you or don't live the same reality as you doesn't mean that there aren't other people doing it. So to be able to be an example for those people is so important.